This is a podcast from the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, a nonpartisan research institute that explores budget policies and issues affecting low and moderate income Americans.
Well, good morning, everyone. I am Iris Lav, Senior Advisor at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, and I'm joined this morning by two other people, Representative Jay Kaufman, who is the House Chair of the Joint Committee on Revenue of the Massachusetts House of Representatives, and Deborah Howlett, who is President of the New Jersey Policy Perspective. And, of course, the subject this morning is property tax caps, and particularly New Jersey's proposal. Today, I'm going to talk specifically about three things. Jay and I will make presentations for about 15 minutes, and then we will open up for questions, and I will call on you, each of you. So today we'll talk specifically about three things. First, why the recent Manhattan Institute report, which I'm sure you've all seen, is misleading. Second, about the evidence that New Jersey isn't a high-tax state. And third, about alternatives to a property tax cap that can lower property taxes. The bottom line is that property tax caps do not change state policies in ways that can make government operate better, smarter, or more efficiently, nor do they necessarily change local government policies in ways that improve governance. Caps can reduce property taxes, of course, but there are many better ways to do that. First, the Manhattan Institute report. The report compares taxes, education spending, and standardized tests in Massachusetts and New Jersey. It argues that a property tax cap, called Proposition 2.5, has reduced property taxes and school spending in Massachusetts without compromising student performance. So the Manhattan Institute would like readers to conclude that a cap would do the same in New Jersey. The Manhattan Institute report does not, however, offer any evidence that Massachusetts students' high performance is the result of 2.5. Instead, it cites a set of state-level education policies Massachusetts has implemented since it enacted an education reform program in 1993 as responsible for their results. So let's roll back the clock. In the early 1990s, a decade after Proposition 2.5 was adopted in 1980, there was widespread understanding that Proposition 2.5 was harming the schools. In 1991, for example, the Massachusetts Board of Education warned that there was a state of emergency created by grossly inadequate financial support of public schools, close quote, and that, quote again, certain classrooms simply warehouse children at this time with no effective education being provided, unquote. Similarly, the Massachusetts Business Alliance for Education wrote in another 1991 report, quote, the public education system is failing to provide its students with the knowledge and skills necessary for them to be productive, informed citizens in coming decades, unquote. The realization that schools were failing and a lawsuit to that effect led to key education reforms in financing, curriculum, and other areas in Massachusetts in 1993, and those reforms are widely considered to be excellent. Other than the fact that the reforms were in part a response to the problems that Proposition 2.5 caused, however, the reforms have nothing at all to do with a property tax cap. They are state policy reforms. Similar reforms could be enacted in New Jersey absent a cap, but no such reforms have been proposed by the governor, who is the one urging adoption of a Massachusetts-style cap. In addition to this basic issue, there are a few specifics of the Manhattan Institute report that are worth discussing. Manhattan Institute highlights the much higher percentage of children who are classified as requiring special education in New Jersey and the higher cost. There are many advocates in New Jersey who have also identified this as a problem. The way local school districts accomplish special education is largely a function of state-level policies. The extent that poor policies are responsible for higher property taxes, those state-level policies could be changed. It has nothing to do with imposing a property tax cap. If there were a cap, local school districts might even be more likely to cut non-special education expenditures because those cuts would be easier to accomplish. Education statistics do show that New Jersey spends considerably more on school administration and in operations and maintenance. But the state already has tools it could use to require school districts to be more efficient in these areas. It could, for example, make changes a condition of receiving state aid. It is worth noting that a factor that is widely believed to account for New Jersey's higher costs, teacher salaries, is not a significant factor. The average annual salary of teachers in public elementary and secondary schools is about the same in Massachusetts and New Jersey. There is a difference of less than 0.5%. So turning to my second point, the analysis we are releasing today also examines whether New Jersey is a high-tax state. It isn't. While New Jersey has the third highest property taxes among the states, that reflects its choice to rely heavily on property tax revenue instead of broad-based state taxes or other types of local taxes to fund schools and local services. Overall, New Jersey has an average level of taxes. New Jersey ranks 24th among the states in the amount of revenues as a percent of residents' incomes that local governments collect to support services. That includes schools, municipalities, and counties. 24th. New Jersey ranks 31st in the country in the amount of revenues that state and local government collect as a percent of residents' income. It is well below the average with respect to its sales taxes, excise taxes, and the charges and fees it imposes. But it is a fact that property taxes are high, and residents apparently are not happy with that situation. So I will conclude with three approaches to lowering property taxes that do not involve a tax cap. First, identify and fix problems causing high property taxes. I already have mentioned a few areas that could be directly reformed and made more efficient, including special education and school administration and operations. In addition, as you probably know, New Jersey has an extremely high number of school districts and municipalities, which leads to duplication of personnel and services. Consolidation may require short-term costs, but in the longer run, it is likely to save money. A second strategy is to provide substantial individual property tax relief. A tax cap can't guarantee relief to any individual property owner, and so some states accomplish individual relief through a circuit breaker or a tax credit that prevents property taxes from exceeding a certain share of a household's income. Finally, it is possible and advisable to shift from property taxes to other sources of revenue. Allowing localities to levy income taxes or sales taxes, as several other states have done, would relieve the pressure on the property tax and could create a more popularly acceptable revenue system. So would reallocating responsibilities between the state and localities so as to support more services from state sources. All of these are possible without a cap. As I've written elsewhere and as Representative Kaufman will now tell you, a cap is likely to have many negative consequences beyond lowering property taxes. So at this point, I will turn it over to Representative Kaufman.
Thank you, Iris. There's an enormous difference between what we're facing in 2010 and what we were facing in 1980 when the voters of Massachusetts voted to pass Prop 2.5 by initiative petition. At the time, the economy was humming, state revenues were in great shape, school enrollments were dropping, health care cost escalation was still well into the future, as were the cumulative impacts of rising fuel prices and dramatically increasing special ed costs. And state revenues supported a massive increase in local aid that was offered to communities in the face of declining local revenues as a result of the impacts of Prop 2.5. None of that is true now. The economy is struggling, state revenues are way down, We certainly are not in a position, I don't think any state is in a position to be terribly generous with local aid at this point, as communities are going to start to feel the effect of any new property tax caps of the sort that's being proposed in New Jersey. And if we were now to account for the kind of budget busters that were not accounted for in 1980, things like health care costs, fuel costs, special ed expenses, OPEB costs, and the like, we would probably adopt something like a Prop 7.5, not a Prop 2.5. So Prop 2.5 basically is an idea whose time has passed, and it would be a bad law right now. It would be an even worse constitutional amendment because it would so hamstring New Jersey citizens and lawmakers that they could not respond to any kind of emergencies. They couldn't respond to changing circumstances absent a constitutional amendment, which, as you know, is a long and cumbersome process, as it probably ought to be. So this inflexibility only adds insult to injury of what otherwise would just be bad policy. Let me just give you a couple of examples from Massachusetts of what Prop 2.5 has meant. And these are just randomly selected examples from the communities that I know about. The city of Quincy, in its 2011 budget, is laying off 150 city employees. Every department is impacted. Police, fire, schools, DPW, social safety net, libraries, you name it. 150 employees laid off. Arlington has lost 120 school positions and 60 municipal positions. Libraries have been cut over 20%. There's widespread recognition and serious concern about declining school services, low teacher morale, and the loss of younger teachers because of the seniority rights of the older teachers. Burlington, a neighboring community of mine, 14 firefighters and 7 police officers were just laid off. Capital projects have been all but abandoned. 70 certified teachers, 18% of the total teaching force, has been laid off. Class size has increased most dramatically in the middle school, but across the board. And special ed, guidance, and alternative education have been most virtually eliminated. That is, the non-required services in those areas have been virtually eliminated. Cambridge, one of our major cities, the DPW is down 77 positions with services noticeably worse across the city. 183 school department positions have been eliminated, including 139 teachers. 2 out of the 7 school nurses are gone, as is a doctor. Class size has increased across the board. There's no gym in grades K to 3 anymore. Special science instruction for grades K to 6, gone. The arts, foreign languages, et cetera, dramatically reduced. Bridgewater. Libraries now only open 14 hours a week. In a community where people just don't have a lot of money, athletic fees have been instituted and range between $300 and $500 per sport. So what was public education is now privately funded by those who can afford it. And this is the most dramatic in Bridgewater, at least. The school committee is actively considering cutting the length of the school day, the state-mandated number of hours of schooling notwithstanding. They just cannot afford to pay their bills. So those and many other examples point to some very, very serious problems with the impacts of Prop 2.5. There's a growing gap between property-rich and property-poor towns. Lexington, where I live, has had recurring overrides, many of them successful. Fall River, Lawrence, New Bedford, some of the poorer communities in the state have had none. And the cut in services to students and to citizens of those communities is most dramatic where public services are most needed, in the poorer communities. There's been a growing reliance on fees and other charges, which, again, may not be so bad for those who are relatively wealthy. It is horrible for those who can't afford them. Maintenance and repair have been virtually eliminated across the state, so we're accumulating capital costs for the next generation. There's enormous tension not only across town boundaries between wealthier and poorer communities, but within a community between the wealthier and poorer residents, wealthier ones figuring they're more likely to be able to vote for a Prop 2.5 override than their poorer neighbors. This is particularly noticeable, certainly in Lexington, I think in virtually every community, as an intergenerational struggle between the seniors who certainly vote and the parents of school-age kids who are most noticeably concerned about the impacts on the schools. So I could go on, but let me just leave any other points for the Q&A other than to say I went into a recent meeting of the Local Governance Advisory Committee, which is a body that meets monthly with the governor and lieutenant governor to advise him on anything having an impact on the cities and towns of Massachusetts. And in anticipation of a trip down to New Jersey to meet with legislators on this, on the governor's proposal, I asked what I should say to my counterparts there about Prop 2.5, and there was a universal thumbs down. It has had an enormous stranglehold on local government and has resulted in a dramatic cut in services and a cut of an ability of communities to govern themselves. And Dutch Leonard, in a study that he did in 1990, so 10 years after Prop 2.5 was passed, entitled the study By Choice or By Chance, and was looking at whether the consequences of Prop 2.5 were intended or unintended. That may have been a legitimate question 10 years in. It is no longer in question. 30 years out, the consequences are dramatic. They are disastrous. And that's just of a law. It would be dramatically worse if this were a constitutional amendment.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. Read commentary from our experts at offthechartsblog.org. Find us on Twitter and Facebook, and create a My Center account at centeronbudget.org.